This week on the Writer's Detective Bureau, being held without charges, stalking, and desk pops. I'm Adam Richardson, and this is the Writer's Detective Bureau. Welcome to episode number 55 of the Writer's Detective Bureau, the podcast dedicated to helping authors and screenwriters write professional quality crime-related fiction. This week, I'd like to thank Gold Shield patrons Deborah Dunbar from DeborahDunbar.com, CC Jameson of CCJameson.com, Larry Keaton, Vicky Tharp of VickyTharp.com, Dharma Kelleher of DharmaKelleher.com, Chris Ann, Jimmy Coe of CrimmyBox, and Larry Darter for their support, along with all of my longtime Coffee Club patrons for their support month after month. You can find links to all of the writers supporting this episode in the show notes at writersdetective.com/55. And to learn about setting up your own Patreon account for your author business, visit writersdetective.com/Patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N. I hope you've all had a great week. I just realized I failed to congratulate the winners of the Writers Detective Bureau one-year anniversary giveaway last week. So congratulations to Elias Barnes, Jennifer Blake, Daniel Miller, Dan Petrosini, who all won Writers Detective logo coffee mugs and one-on-one story consultations with yours truly. And then also huge congratulations to Amanda Fairbend, who won all of that plus a full license for Scrivener writing software. I hope you enjoy writing with Scrivener, Amanda. There is a bit of a learning curve, but oh my goodness, once you get the hang of it, you won't want to write in any other word processing software. I wish I could write my police reports in Scrivener. I just find it frustrating when I have to write in anything else. If you would like to check out Scrivener for free for 30 days, and that's like 30 days of actually sitting down to write, opening the software, not 30 days on a calendar, because Literature and Latte, the company that makes it, really understands how we work as writers. But you get your free 30-day trial by going to writersdetectivebureau.com/Scrivener. And that's spelled S-C-R-I-V-E-N-E-R. Scrivener is available for Windows, Mac, and even iOS, which I use way more often than I ever thought I would, working on my iPhone and on my iPad. So yeah, check it out. And congrats again, Amanda, Elias, Jennifer, Daniel, and Dan. And thank you so much for listening to the podcast over the last year. I appreciate you so much. So this week, I didn't get any new questions for the podcast. So I will see you guys next week. Thanks. No, I'm just kidding. So I picked a few questions that popped up in the Writer's Detective Q&A Facebook group for this week's content. Joey Manning asked, how long can the police hold you without charging you? This is a commonly asked question amongst crime fiction writers. I've seen it over and over and over again. And the answer is somewhere between 24 and 48 and maybe at the absolute maximum, 72 hours. And by charging, that really means having a judge review the probable cause to hold you and even conduct an arraignment. So that does not mean 48 to 72 hours in an interview room. This is more of sitting in a jail cell and waiting to appear before a judge. So what happens if the defendant is still sitting in a jail cell, uncharged, at that 72-hour mark, and the police refuse to let him out? Well, his attorney can file a habeas corpus petition with the court, which is a legal shit or get off the pot moment. I apologize for the language. But a habeas corpus petition is a writ filed with the court requiring the detained subject be brought before the judge in order to secure that detainee's release unless the prosecutor or police show that there is probable cause for that detention. And before you ask, habeas corpus is Latin for, or at least the literal translation, for that you have the body. But it's taken to mean that the court demands that the body be brought before them, the court. And for a little quick cop humor pun, I have known an officer or two to refer to making an arrest or getting an arrest warrant as instead of habeas corpus, habeas grabus. He thought he was going to get away, but I put the old habeas grabus on him. Anyway, contrary to the tropes in fiction of losing the paperwork on this guy, reality is that we don't really run into this kind of intentional delay, especially in a murder case. Because, number one, everything that happens in a murder case is under the microscope. And two, we tend to strategize our moves where we aren't backed into this corner during an investigation. The dude's either free to go or he isn't. Now, we may call him in for an interview and then let him go, but there will be a strategy for doing that. So what might that strategy be? It could be that letting him leave voluntarily cements the fact that he was not in custody during the interview because he wasn't admonished for Miranda, making it legitimately go like a witness interview, not a suspect interrogation. Or it could be we're using it as a slight delay tactic, meaning only a few hours, maybe just enough to get up on a wiretap investigation on his cell phone. Or it may simply be the best way to see what car he's rolling in and then get a surveillance team to follow him after he leaves the station. Hanging on to him in hopes that new evidence will magically appear is not a very good investigative tactic, and it's one that will bite you and your investigation in the butt later on. So just remember that detectives that are good at their jobs are the ones that know how to succeed by playing within the rules, because those rules are there for a reason. Tracy Milosevic asked this question in the Facebook group. I'm writing a fictional crime novel, and I'd like to keep the authorities' investigation as legitimate as possible so I can keep the story accurate. If a stalker is stalking and parking a vehicle outside a person's home, including visiting the person's place of employment, are there certain protocols in place before suggesting the victim get a restraining order? In the story I'm writing, the person who is stalking does no harm and no illegal violations. But is there still something that authorities can physically do? So the first resource that I would like to point to before we get into answering this question a little deeper is for you to be able to take a look at the stalking laws that are on the books in all of the states in the United States. You can find that at victimsofcrime.org. It's kind of a long URL. So if you go to the show notes at writersdetective.com/55, that link will be there. And for California, the stalking law is 646.9 of the California Penal Code. And so just the description that Tracy listed of parking a vehicle outside a person's home or visiting their place of employment, those kind of things can actually be a violation, a stalking violation. So 646.9 of the California Penal Code, the stalking law, says any person who willfully, maliciously, and repeatedly follows or willfully and maliciously harasses another person and who makes a credible threat with the intent to place that person in reasonable fear for his or her safety or the safety of his or her immediate family is guilty of the crime of stalking. And for the purposes of this section, harasses means engages in a knowing and willful course of conduct directed at a specific person that seriously alarms, annoys, torments, or terrorizes the person, and that serves no legitimate purpose. And then course of conduct means two or more acts occurring over a period of time, however short, evidencing of a continuity of purpose. And it doesn't count for constitutionally protected activity. And then a credible threat means a verbal or written threat, including that performed through the use of an electronic communication device, or a threat implied by a pattern of conduct or a combination of verbal, written, or electronically communicated statements and conduct. And it goes on. The courts have actually found that even simply drawing your finger across your throat, the whole going to get you kind of, you know, slit your throat kind of pantomime can count as a nonverbal threat. So if there are text messages or emails that sound threatening and he is sitting across the street from work or from the house, that may be enough for a stalking charge. And there are other crimes that could also be in play here, like vehicle tampering or peeping or prowling or trespassing. So to answer the question about something that authorities can physically do, I actually want to refer to one of the most important books I've ever read, and I think everyone should read. I don't care who you are. And it's a book called The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker. And I'll have a link to the book in the show notes, and I'll talk about it here in a little bit. But I just want to read a few excerpts from a chapter on spousal abuse and dealing with a stalking ex from The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker. So how does the system usually respond to society's most predictable murder risk? It tells the woman to go to court, to civil court, and sue her abuser to stay away. In many states, this is called a temporary restraining order because it is expected to restrain the aggressor. In some states, it's called a protection order, expected to protect the victim. In fact, on its own, it doesn't achieve either goal. Lawyers, police, TV news people, counselors, psychologists, and even some victims' advocates recommend restraining orders wholesale. They're a growth industry in this country. We should perhaps consider putting them on the New York Stock Exchange, but we should stop telling people that a piece of paper will automatically protect them, because when applied to certain types of cases, it may do the opposite. It is dangerous to promote a specific treatment without first diagnosing the problem in the individual case. Many homicides have occurred at the courthouse where the women were seeking protection orders or just prior to the hearings. Why? Because the murderers were allergic to rejection. They found it hard enough in private, but intolerable in public. For men like this, rejection is a threat to the identity, the persona, to the entire self. And in this sense, their crimes could be called murder in defense of the self. In To Have or To Harm, the first major book on stalking, author Lyndon Gross details case after case in which court orders did not prevent homicides. Restraining orders are most effective on the reasonable person who has a limited emotional investment. In other words, they work best on the person least likely to be violent anyway. Also, there is a substantial difference between using a restraining order on an abusive husband and using one on a man you dated a couple of times. That difference is the amount of emotional investment and entitlement the man feels. With a date stalker, the TRO, or temporary restraining order, orders him to leave the woman alone and go about his life as it was before he met her. The same court order used on an estranged husband asks him to abandon, at the stroke of a judge's signature, the central features of his life, his intimate relationship, his control and ownership of another human being, his identity as a powerful man, his identity as a husband, and on and on. Thus, a TRO might ask one man to do something he can easily do, while it asks another to do something far more difficult. This distinction has been largely ignored by the criminal justice system. DeBecker goes on to say, "Above all, I want to encourage people to ask this simple question. Will a restraining order help or hurt in my particular case? At least then, whatever choice is made can be called a choice and not an automatic reaction. Think of restraining orders as an option, not the only option. Among those options, I certainly favor law enforcement interventions such as arrests for battery, assault, breaking and entering, or other violations of law." In a subsequent chapter on stalking by someone who has romantic aspirations, often someone the woman has met or dated, DeBecker writes, "Another rule to be taught in the getting rid of Mr. Wrong class would be the way to stop contact is to stop contact. As I noted above, I suggest one explicit rejection, and after that, absolutely no contact. If you call the pursuer back, or agree to meet, or send him a note, or have somebody warn him off, you buy another 6 weeks of his unwanted pursuit. Some victims think it will help to have a male friend, new boyfriend, or a male family member tell the stalker to stop. Most who try this learn that the stalker takes it as evidence that his love object must be conflicted. Otherwise, she'd have told him herself. Sending the police to warn off a pursuer may seem the obvious thing to do, but it rarely has the desired effect. Though the behavior of pursuers may be alarming, most have not broken the law, so the police have few options. When police visit him and say, in effect, cut this out or you'll get in trouble, the pursuer intuitively knows that if they could have arrested him, they would have arrested him. So what's the result of the visit? Well, the greatest possible weapon in the victim's arsenal, sending the police after him, came and went without a problem. The cops stopped by, they talked to him, and they left. Who got stronger, the victim or the pursuer? To be clear, I feel that the police should be involved when there is an actionable crime that, if prosecuted, would result in improving the victim's safety or putting a high cost on the stalker's behavior. But the first time a stalker should see the police is when they show up to arrest him, not when they stop by to chat. Again, the name of this book that I've just read excerpts from is The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker, and you need to read this book. There are not many books that I say everyone should read, but this is one of them. I don't care if you're a man or a woman, a teenage girl, or a battle-hearted Marine, I guarantee you will learn something from this book that may just save your life or the life of a loved one. You can go to writersdetectivebureau.com/gift of fear, which will take you to the book's Amazon page. Now, that is an affiliate link, so if you click it, I might earn a little bit of money from it. But if you are a Kindle Unlimited subscriber, you can read it on your Kindle for free. And this week's last question also comes from the Facebook group, and it's asked by Erica Pera, who wrote, "Would a detective assigned to permanent desk duty also be assigned a weapon?" Unless you are Will Ferrell in The Other Guys and think desk pops are a real thing, then most likely, yes. Being able to carry a firearm is actually a job requirement for being a sworn officer in the United States, including the rank of detective. Being able to carry a firearm can mean a variety of things. First, you regularly qualify at the range, meaning you demonstrate your proficiency. In fact, I literally just got home from doing that today. And failing to do so, usually after at least a few attempts at remediation, not just one or two off days at the range, but failing to qualify, can lead to losing your job. This can also mean that you've suffered a traumatic injury, leaving you unable to fulfill the requirements of the job. I've seen this happen where an officer suffered brain damage, and though they let him help in the detective bureau, he was transitioned from a sworn officer position to a civilian position at the same pay rate. The department took care of him when it came to keeping his pay and saving face, of course, but the department could not take on the liability of him carrying a gun. One other way you can lose your gun and your job is through a criminal conviction or restraining order. If you batter your spouse, you have put your career in serious jeopardy, because even misdemeanor domestic violence convictions or any kind of family violence restraining order automatically results in the forfeiture of your ability to even have a firearm in your immediate possession. And not to get too technical, but being a detective often is permanent desk duty, going back to the original question. Okay, I guess we do leave the station and make arrests, but sometimes it feels like you are locked in your cubicle and working on reports, not using Scrivener forever. Thank you so much for listening this week. Don't forget, you have homework this week. Read The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker. You can find it at writersdetectivebureau.com/gift of fear. Send me your crime fiction questions. Don't let me go another dry week. Send me questions by going to writersdetective.com/podcast. Even if it's something you think that's been asked before, there's always a new lesson to share from an old question. So thanks again for listening. Have a great week and write well.